Most people probably get soaked most of the day before visiting.
Our program tonight is focusing on increasing militarization and integration of the Mexican Army with the police forces in Mexico. The strategy was some people call low-intensity war, which some people have started to call civilian targeted war because it's not too low in the country, it's pretty high potential. And the relationship of these changes in Mexico, and most of them talk mostly about the U.S. border, to human rights abuses. And the centerpiece of our program tonight is a film that's about 35 minutes long called La Guerra Punta, or the Digging War, which does have English dubs and subtitles. Which we're going to be showing on this VCR. So if you're not a Spanish speaker at that time, you will be able to use the subtitles. So you may be to, like, I don't know, rearrange ourselves in a tight room in front of the VCR. Following that, I'm going to tell you a little bit about the harassment that an organization, the Miguel Agustín Juárez Human Rights Center in Mexico City, is an organization that CCAP has worked with. Edgar Cortez, who is a previous one of the staff people of the Central Pro, was in June last November 1998, spoke here at the Media Center and spoke at our regional conference as part of the Mexico Solidarity Network. So we have some real personal ties to this Human Rights Center. And we're going to do some letter writing to try to generate some support for the center. They've been coming under a wide range of threats, death threats, had staff who were kidnapped, and they've been very much targeted, had to walk through broken and confused buildings, etc. I was glad to see that Matt here has come back from Mexico, and in fact worked with them in a variety of other human rights centers in Guerrero. So I look forward to any additions that you might want to make for. I'm just going to try to outline a few things to frame the film for people who may not be familiar with the situation of Mexico and the relationship of the United States, particularly United States economic policy, but also the way in which the United States has been training Mexican military forces, particularly through the School of the Americas. When we look at Mexico now, there's an interesting sort of conjuncture of the coexistence of what many call neoliberal economic policy or restructuring policy, limited openings in terms of electoral politics, and I'm serious when I say limited, I'm not one of these people who advocates that we're in a transition to democracy and we're almost there in Mexico. I think we're in a transition. We're still in the beginnings of that. And at the same time that the electoral arena has slightly opened in some ways and very much not in others, and there's neoliberal economic policy, there's a militarization, a surveillance of Mexican society. This has all happened simultaneously, and it always makes me think of how well capitalism worked under Pinochet, Chile, and I sort of watched Mexico. I think there's a relationship between certain forms of democracy, limited democracy, neoliberal economics, and militarization of society. And that's really what the film is putting out. Neoliberal economic policy in Mexico has privatized all state-owned enterprises. It's made it possible to privatize land. About 50% of Mexican territory was held in a non-private status, legal status, and now it's legally possible for all of that privatized. And in general, the policy focuses a lot more on the needs of foreign capital than it does on domestic consumers and producers in Mexico. Most people are familiar with NAFTA from 1994, and social polarization, in a nutshell, has been an economic polarization. It's been the result of NAFTA. Last year, more than 50 million people in Mexico, more than half the population, still lived in poverty. Between 1994 and 1998, the minimum wage in Mexico had lost about 23% of its value. So people are earning less and paying more. And one of the other things that's happened is this economic structure that favors the needs of capital and recovery back on social welfare spending has been a accompanied to a certain degree with a loosening on the part of the party that's been in power for 7 years, the party of the Institutionalized Revolution, the Free, have partially loosened control of the electoral process. This film starts with the victory of Cuauhtemoc Cárdenas when he won the mayorship of Mexico City. And this was very, very important that this happened because the mayor of Mexico City had always been appointed by the president, had never been elected. That happened. There were some governorships that went to opposition parties, mostly of the right, some mayorships that went to the left. So there was a loosening in some areas. The Free had primaries for the first time this year. They, in fact, elected their candidate instead of having the president appoint them. And for a period of time, there actually were two competing candidates for the Free nomination. This apparent political opening, however, has been accompanied by a very frightening strategy, which is pretty much invisible to people who measure transitions to democracy only by are their opposition candidates allowed to run in elections and do election predictions prove. There's one chair there, and there's one moving, and there's going to sit down here. There's been a simultaneous strategy setting up very detailed systems of surveillance and intimidation that have worked not only on opposition political parties, particularly the party of the PRD, the Party of the Democratic Revolution, but have also been actively working on infiltrating and collecting information on ONGs, NGOs, non-governmental organizations, and on a whole range of independent organizations, peasant organizations, indigenous organizations, women's organizations, basically any kind of social movement that has an independent profile in the country. And human rights organizations in particular have been targeted because human rights organizations are busy documenting the violation of human rights of other sectors of society that I just mentioned. This strategy of surveillance and intimidation and psychological warfare involves, first of all, a war of covert intelligence and the development of a sophisticated intelligence apparatus. Secondly, the civilian targeted aspect of this war, which is often called low intensity, but which I said I think is pretty high intensity, involves intimidation, harassment, and a constant military presence, getting people in society used to, accustomed to seeing different kinds of military presence, whether that's the army, police, or special kinds of police. And finally, it's involved very explicitly the militarization of the police forces and the centering of the military. The film talks about this a lot. The centering of the military in all public security and intelligence gathering operations. So what may have been 6 or 7 different police forces and a lot of different intelligence gathering efforts have been centralized, and the army runs them, so it's been integrated. Okay, where does Mexico get the training, technology, and equipment for this? Right here, from the United States. The majority of arms used by, and equipment used by Mexican Army and police are purchased from the United States, also from Israel, from Brazil, from some other countries. But the point is that we are actually, we're not giving military aid. It is, we're selling it, okay? So it's a you know, financial transaction. Increasingly, if you monitor from especially 92 through 96, you can see the shift in the kinds of purchases that Mexico is making in surveillance equipment, arms, and you see what is supposed to be for fighting the drug war actually starts to look like stuff to control civilians. Batons, shields, night scopes, cattle prods, some of the kinds of equipment that you really don't need for fighting the drug war. It's very, it's crowd control equipment, some of it, and of course also includes arms. I don't have that figure. There's a figure in the film for the percentage. percentage of the budget of Mexico that is spent on military equipment. If you're really interested, I might be able to dig it up. I was trying to come up with it, and I couldn't come up with it for the most recent figure. Most of the training that is used in operationalizing the civilian target or the strategy of intelligence and intimidation comes from people from the Mexican army who are sent to the schools of the School of the Americas, and then they pass on what they've learned to other people. Most of you probably know the School of the Americas was founded in 1946 by the U.S. Army to help Latin American governments promote stability and democracy. That's what the founding charter says. In 1984, the SOA was moved to Fort Benning, Georgia, where it still is. The School of the Americas has offered instruction in the following: counter-guerrilla manuals, extortion, physical and psychological torture, military intelligences, courses in commando and sniper operations, interrogation techniques, terrorism, urban guerrilla warfare, counterinsurgency, low-intensity warfare, irregular warfare, jungle warfare, counterintelligence training, and anti-drug operations, among others. And people in the Mexican army have taken many of those kinds of courses. The Mexican Department of National Defense has reported that over a 20-year period from 1978 to 1998, 4,172 military personnel received training abroad, of which 61% of them have taken courses since 1994. 1994 is the year that the Zapatista Rebellion began in Chiapas, and shortly thereafter, in 96, with the appearance of one other major military, and there are dozens of armed guerrilla groups in Mexico right now. So since 94, the number of people getting foreign military training has increased dramatically. In the first year following the Zapatista Rebellion, 766 Mexican military personnel were trained in the SOA. In 1996, the School of the Americas developed two special courses just for Mexican military personnel. Special Mexican training course, and one they call the Teachers Administration Training Course for the Mexican Army. The Mexican Army has also sent students to a wide range of other countries for training, including Israel, and the Mexican Army has also studied with the Caibiles of Guatemala, of playing as the most ruthless counterinsurgency unit of the Guatemalan Army, responsible for many, many massacres. Between 1996 and 1999, 3,200 members of another part of the military, the Special Forces Aircraft Detention Group, graduated from a counterinsurgency course given by the Green Berets, MS. A Pentagon document from 1997 confirmed that the Mexican government sent 1,500 military personnel for training in the U.S. It adds that military technology transfers from the U.S. to Mexico increased by 400% in 1997. That is, things like radar, television surveillance, a whole, computer surveillance, breaking news, all of that kind of technology. That same year in 1997, the Mexican Department of Defense increased by 800% its allocation for the training of Mexican military personnel. And this past year, the Mexican military budget increased by 15%. And there's now much more money in the military budget in Mexico than there is in social welfare programs. The film makes that point. Something else that's happened in Mexico is that a new police force has recently been created called the Federal Preventative Police, which have been appearing more and more in confrontations with civilians. They are approaching 10,000 members this year. 5,000 of them are from the army. And increasingly, this police is involved in a wide range of counterinsurgency and civilian targeting operations. And a lot of times now in Mexico, whenever there is an operation, they see people from the military, from the preventative police, from the federal judicial police, from state police. They see four or five different kinds of police and military forces integrated into one unit. You can even see them in the roadblocks that are throughout Mexico. It's no longer just the army. Also, usually states people from immigration. Now, one point I wanted to just make is that when we talk about the militarization of Mexico, the same point in time, we have also really upped militarization of our own border in some of the same ways. The United States, especially under Ashley Clinton, has greatly increased the number of Border Patrol agents. We're supposed to be adding 1,000 new Border Patrol agents a year. I read recently in a New York Times article that we were only able to recruit 384 in 1999, not achieving that goal. But the U.S. border, in that same period of time, we've seen an increase in militarization in Mexico, has also been incredibly militarized physically in terms of triple walls and new roads and floodlights. There's now like 30 miles of the Rio Grande with floodlights on it. The U.S. Army was stopped from participating directly in border patrols when a Marine shot a young man on the Texas border, I believe, 2 years ago now. But the U.S. Army maintains all of the roads, offers training, and offers equipment to the Border Patrol and to IMS. So I think it's just important for us to keep in mind that we can't just look at Mexico and say Mexico is militarizing. In fact, that same thing has been going on our own border. And we could talk about U.S. cities and the kind of police forces that we have in cities as well, and the kind of police actions that go on in immigration raids in the U.S. And these strategies of deterrence and militarization in the border have also caused a lot of death. 1,185 people have died while crossing the border in a three-year period. That's a lot of people because of exposure, drowning, dehydration. The last thing I want to talk about briefly before we watch the film is the way that this strategy works in terms of targeting human rights organizations, and also the prevention of international observers, the discouragement of international observers in Mexico. Do you guys want to come in? Mary Robinson, who is the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, made a visit to Mexico in November of last year, and she went to Chiapas for a visit. And she noted, quote, that the heavy presence of Mexican troops in Chiapas is causing human rights abuses at a grassroots level. And that could be extended not only to Chiapas, but there's a heavy presence of military troops in a number of other areas in Mexico as well. And as you'll see in the film, in Mexico City and in other urban areas, in Guerrero, in Hidalgo, and also in the state of Oaxaca. Among the abuses that Mary Robinson noted were disappearances, detention, torture, and violence against women. She said that she was overwhelmed by the presence of troops, and she was so overwhelmed by the documentation she got of human rights abuses in Mexico, she had to buy two extra suitcases to carry back to the UN for all of the documentation that she received about human rights abuses in Mexico. I have this image of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights with these two suitcases just stuffed with these documents of human rights abuses throughout Mexico, and I think that's a pretty compelling image. And many, many different groups have been targeted, and those have been mentioned in the film, but I wanted to particularly mention human rights organizations. These are the organizations that, in fact, they exist at local levels, at state levels. Some of them are national, and they're networked in a national way, and some of them are networked globally. But systematically, in Mexico, human rights organizations who are defending the human rights of a wide range of other societal sectors are victims themselves, and very deliberate victims. Most people who work in human rights organizations throughout Mexico regularly face death threats by the phone, at home, or in their office. They face office break-ins. Almost every single office gets broken into very often. Some offices get broken into once a month, a few times a year. In many cases, all of their computer records or their computers are robbed, so that all the information that they have documenting abuses and collecting evidence then gets turned over to military intelligence. So these break-ins are about collecting information and then trying to stop the work of those particular organizations and stop them from defending even particular people. Staff from human rights organizations have been detained, they have been kidnapped, they have been tortured, and they have also been killed. After the film, I'm going to report briefly on one organization that has a close relationship with CISCAF, as I mentioned, the Miguel Agustin Juarez Human Rights Center in Mexico City. And I'm going to ask you to help us in generating some letters to the Mexican president to defend the work that this organization has been doing. They have suffered all of those things that I just mentioned. An additional policy of the Mexican government has been to deport foreigners who are engaged in human rights observing or who are simply associating themselves, even in cultural events, with any organization which is viewed as problematic or in opposition to the government, particularly the DCLN in Chiapas. Since 1994, Mexican immigration authorities have expelled over 300 international visitors, accusing them of violating their visas. And just recently, last week, there were another 41 people who were detained by Mexican immigration as a result of their participation in a Zapatista New Year's celebration and the opening of a high school for indigenous, a junior high school for indigenous students in Ogun Peak, Chiapas. I have read of three of them so far that have been reported. I don't know the outcome of all 41 cases, but clearly another strategy. And the coordinator of the Mexico Solidarity Network, Tom Hansen, has made a very significant observation when he says, since 1994, there's not been a single extrajudicial murder in an indigenous community in Chiapas where human rights observers were present. So the strategy of keeping observers out is very, very important, and also the press. There have been also instances where the Mexican government has essentially sealed off areas so that either the Mexican press or the foreign press can get in, and that allows, of course, all kinds of things to happen that would not happen if there were witnesses. So that's the end of what I wanted to say to introduce the film. So can you put it on? And then we'll talk about the letter writing that you're doing. And another effort, legislative effort, that's underway in the United States.
Maybe it's easier. I want to say that from the preliminary results that my party, the Institutional Revolutionary Party, has received up to this moment, we see a tendency in favor of the party of the democratic revolution.
¡Fuera los militares! ¡Fuera los militares! ¡Fuera los militares!
After almost 60 years without elections, the citizens of the federal district have elected Cuauhtémoc Cárdenas of the Democratic Revolution Party, PRD, to head the government of the federal district. The PRD, severely harassed during the regime of Salinas de Gortari, made important advances in the election of federal deputies held the same day. The National Action Party, PAN, has won two new governorships, and the party in power, PRI, with high voter turnout in the most poor and marginalized regions of the country, maintains a precarious majority in Congress. The failure of the PRI to win votes in the federal district and in major cities throughout the country is evident.
Tiene la palabra el ciudadano
Ernesto Zedillo Ponce de León, President of the Mexican United States. You have the floor. You have the floor.
September. For the first time in decades, the president faces a legislature that is not unconditionally in his favor.
Lo más urgente
of the greatest urgency is the reestablishment of peace and agreement among Mexicans and the reestablishment of the rule of law with the desire to rise above violence. The end of this silent war, nurtured and fueled by impunity, corruption, vast inequality, and intolerable misery.
Nevertheless, Zedillo insists upon defending the economic model that the citizenry rejected by not voting for the PRI just 2 months earlier.
Se pueden examinar y perfeccionar detalles, programas específicos, particularidades, pero estoy convencido de que las bases esenciales son correctas y de respetarse, nos conducirán al crecimiento con empleos y mejores salarios que México necesita.
While some 20 million Mexicans are condemned to live in extreme poverty, the government spends thousands of millions of pesos to save the companies it recently sold to private individuals from bankruptcy. Millions of families survive on 40 US cents a day. On top of it all, the government designates thousands of millions of dollars a year to cover the service of an unpayable external debt. And listen to this.
El pueblo exige vivir en un país donde las leyes y la justicia se apliquen a todos por igual, sin excepciones, sin impunidad. Por eso, haremos un esfuerzo mucho mayor para combatir la inseguridad pública y la corrupción. Por eso también, todos pondremos nuestra parte en la construcción de un México de leyes y justicia.
Another good proposal that has not been reached for all Mexicans, a problem rooted in the Salinas era. Since the first day of his administration, Carlos Salinas de Gortari used the armed forces for functions outside the mandates of the law. With citizens disagreeing with the official election results, an unusual parade January 1989, the arrest of petroleum leader Joaquín Hernández Galicia. Another incident in which the army is involved in work assigned by law to the police. Workers' demonstrations on May 1st, 1989. Mexico City's downtown is besieged. Reluctant to accept the triumph of the Democratic Revolution Party in the polls, the Salinas administration faces dozens of post-electoral conflicts. In some of these, primarily in the state of Michoacán, troops are frequently used outside the provisions of the law. While Salinas was governing with increasing help from the military, and denunciations of human rights violations were on the rise. In 1990, the National Human Rights Commission, an organization dependent on the executive power, was created with its boss function to watch over the executive in these matters. It is February 1986. Ernesto Zedillo is now president, and soldiers in Tabasco confront Chontales, who are blocking oil wells in demand of compensation for ecological damage provoked by Pemex, the Mexican petroleum company. Once again, the armed forces confront civil opposition. The new Defense Secretary, General Enrique Cervantes, is familiar with these duties. Here he is, commanding the Plaza of the Constitution, December 1, 1988, during the formal induction of Carlos Salinas. The economic crisis that marked the beginning of Zedillo's term brought innumerable social conflicts with it. Mexico City is the scene of some 7 demonstrations daily. This year, around 500,000 people protest for long overdue solutions to labor, housing, justice, education, and land distribution problems. The risk of more social uprising is latent. Other conflicts, which originated in years of injustice, continue without change. The existence of at least 2 important armed groups in extremely poor and marginalized regions is openly challenged by the Mexican army. In Chiapas, the Zapatista National Liberation Army is threatened by the unwillingness to comply with the San Andres agreements. The EPR, Popular Revolutionary Army, is active primarily in Guerrero and Oaxaca, an armed conflict without the slightest hint of resolution. The economic crisis brings a notable increase in the incidence of crime throughout the country. Nevertheless, the government talks of combating drug trafficking, armed groups, and crime. But they take measures which affect common citizens' rights. Restrictions of guarantees, previously very infrequent, are considered tolerable, such as the privacy of telephone calls and the psychiatric hospitals. Did you know that the legal reforms permit the seclusion of any person without access to family visits and without any possibility of appeal? Perhaps psychiatric seclusions instead of prison? Since December 1995, the law allows the army to leave their barracks to participate in civil posts.
It should be insisted that the president has judicially defined limits on his power. He should use one instrument for one function and a different one for another function. This has been confused, and soldiers in civilian clothing are being used to perform police labor. This is, even in its disguised manner, unacceptable. I insist, they can apologize all they want, but they continue using members of the armed forces. This is not legally justified, and police should be used for public security purposes, and the army should be used for matters of national security, and not for both mixed together.
Ahora, en lugar de ajustar los actos de autoridad a la Constitución, se ajusta la Constitución a los actos de autoridad, se reforma la autoridad.
Now, instead of adjusting acts of authority to the Constitution is adjusted to the acts of authority. Authorities make constitutional reforms, and so therefore, now the laws against organized crime that furthermore establish a regimen of exception that violate the guarantee of equality, the guarantee to legality, the guarantee to judicial security, because every person has the same rights and the same guarantees. And in this case, the people that fall under the jurisdiction of the federal law against organized crime have their guarantees limited. It is not only telephone monitoring. It could be any method. And therefore, it's an invasion of privacy of the people.
The media and its noble social work to extol daily violence and instill fear.
Capillo atraviesa la noche para irrumpir en los parajes del delito. Mario Ramírez recorre nuestra ciudad desnuda para captar las imágenes del peligro detrás de la lente. Ellos son reporteros de Ciudad Desnuda.
The psychosis of violence and extremes of chaos. Episodes of lynching, thieves, rapists, and kidnappers multiply in the face of the ineffectiveness of the judicial institutions. Justice by their own hands, the burden of daily crime, the ever more visible operation of drug trafficking, and the image of the inefficiency and corruption of a police force underpaid and poorly trained for decades. All used as justification for the installment of the army in police functions. In 1997, a strategic post of the Ministry of Public Security or Police in Mexico City are held by 21 military officers and only 2 civilians. Over 2,500 police from Iztapalapa in the Federal District are replaced by soldiers. The president of the National Human Rights Commission, Mireille Drogati, applauds these changes while citizens gradually become accustomed to the treatment of presumed criminals.
No,
I think it is very clear that the ruling powers that have decided to create this crime protect it and foster it, because it needs to create terror in many sectors of society that in a very non-analytical way will demand order, and then this justifies laws such as a law that coordinates the public security bases, justifying that the army can intervene in the life of civilians, justifies the judicial framework that has destroyed the framework we previously had, justifies, in quotation marks, because none of this is legitimate, of course, justifies the reforms to the Constitution, legalizing the violations which would be committed, and the exorbitant powers which have been given to the absolutely corrupt and ineffective public ministry so that they can complete their job.
The individual guarantees of many are suspended in practice. The soldiers, in police uniforms, impose a virtual state of emergency. The results of the action of the military do not agree with what was promised. 2,650 operations carried out with 18,817 people arrested. In August of 1997, 1,500 police were used to arrest 700 suspected criminals. Of these, only 12 remain in custody. That is to say, 125 policemen were needed to arrest each suspect. After 7 months of militarization, the incidence of crime went up by almost 100%.
And what we are seeing is extremely violent crime generated from these sectors of power. A few days ago, well, last week,
I heard some truly terrifying cases. Two businessmen, two merchants, I can't say their names because they asked me not to, were kidnapped, and they cut half an ear off each one and sent it to their families. In both cases, they were chained to a laboratory, and in both cases, they paid ransom of millions of dollars. But even worse, in both cases, they took no precautions to prevent the victims from knowing that the police were involved.
High State Police Commanders of the Judicial Police and the National Institute to Combat Drugs are in place on large scale throughout the country. In August of 1997, the number of army personnel occupying police positions reached 100 in Chihuahua, 222 in Tamaulipas, 160 in Sonora, while in Baja California, the number reaches 96. And in Southern Baja California, Coahuila, Quintana Roo, and Campeche, military presence is evident. Guerrero, Oaxaca, Chiapas, and Hidalgo have a strong presence of troops, and the rest of the states also note an increase in members of the armed forces. Less visible and unknown number of soldiers dressed as civilians are gathering information and intelligence. The anonymous vigilant.
It seems to me then that this is one of the primary consequences, to instill generalized fear, beginning with the discourse that guarantees public security. On the other hand, this fear is always a demobilized and paralyzed fear. It can demobilize whatever initiative in order to plan demands in an unequal society which calls for the demand. It demands that the society plan its necessities, given that poverty is ever more visible and the exclusion of participation ever more visible. Then, the strategy of militarization, though of as a strategy of vigilance, permits the demobilization of social organization.
The fight against crime is less effective than the repression of organized civil groups. It is the city of Chihuahua, May 22, 1987. Police forces attend to indigenous people, Jaramuris and Tepehuanes, who demand a solution to the problems of land ownership.